and knew that another Harry stood beside him, hidden by his own Deathly Hallow. Harry then told his cloak to hide himself from himself once more, and it did. Being able to perceive your future self meant having to match the memory later. Harry's own voice said then, sounding strange in present Harry's ears,
"He has a surprisingly good explanation."
Present Harry remembered the words as best he could. Nothing more was said between them. Professor Quirrell walked to Draco's form and chanted the spell of the false memory charm. The defense professor stood there for perhaps a minute, seemingly lost to the world. Harry had been studying obliviations these last couple of weeks, though he couldn't have helped cast the spells, unless he was willing to exhaust himself completely, and for some reason they wanted an aura to lose every single life memory involving the color blue. But Harry had some idea now of the concentration which the far more difficult false memory charm entailed. You had to try to live the other person's entire life inside your own head, at least if you wanted to create the false memories with less than a 16-to-1 slowdown as you separately crafted 16 major tracks of memory. It might have been quiet. There might have been no outward sign, but Harry knew something of the difficulties now, and he knew to be impressed. Professor Quirrell finished, and moved on to Tracy Davis, then to the three auras, and finally Professor McGonagall. Harry waited, but future Harry made no protest. It was possible that even Professor McGonagall, if she'd been awake, wouldn't have protested. It was not yet the Ides of May, and apparently there would be a surprisingly good explanation. With a gesture, Draco's stunned body was lifted and sent a short distance into the woods, before being carefully deposited on the ground. Then, a final gesture from Professor Quirrell ripped a huge chunk out of the unicorn's side, leaving behind ragged edges. The raw meat hovered in the air, then wavered in vanishment and was gone.
"Done," Professor Quirrell said. "I must depart this place now, Mr. Potter. Come with me and remain here."
Professor Quirrell strode away, and Harry followed, and remained behind. They walked through the woods in silence for a time, before Harry heard faint voices in the distance. The next set of auras, presumably, after the first set had fallen out of contact. What his future self was saying, Harry didn't know.
"They won't detect us, nor hear our speech," said Professor Quirrell.
The sense of power and doom around the defense professor was still strong. The man seated himself on a tree stump, one where the light of the almost full moon fell full on him.
"I should first say that when you speak to the auras in the future, you should tell them that you frightened away the seething dark, the same as you did that Dementor. It is what Mr. Malfoy will remember seeing."
Professor Quirrell gave a small sigh.
"Ah, it may cause some alarm if they conclude that some horror, kin to Dementors, and strong enough to break the Order's shields, is loose in the Forbidden Forest. But I could not think of what else to do. If the forest is better guarded after this, but with any luck I have already consumed what I need. Would you mind telling me how you arrived so quickly? How did you know Mr. Malfoy was in trouble?"
After Captain Brodsky had learned that Draco Malfoy was in the Forbidden Forest, seemingly in the company of Rubius Hagrid, Brodsky had begun inquiring to find out who had authorized this, and had still been unable to find out when Draco Malfoy had missed check-in. Despite Harry's protests, the Aura captain, who was authorized to know about time-turners, had refused to allow deployment to before the time of the missed check-in. There were standard procedures involving time, but Brodsky had given Harry written orders allowing him to go back and deploy an Aura trio to arrive 1 second after the missed check-in time. There had been a Patronus charm to locate Draco, which Harry had successfully willed to take the form of a ball of pure silver light, and the flight of Auras had arrived on time to the second.
"I'm afraid I couldn't say," Harry replied evenly. Professor Quirrell was still a major suspect, and it was good for him not to know the details. "Now, why are you eating unicorns?"
"Ah," Professor Quirrell said. "As to that..."
The man hesitated.
"I was drinking the blood of unicorns, not eating them. The missing flesh, the ragged marks upon the body, those were to obscure the case, to make it seem like some other predator. The use of unicorn's blood is too well known."
"I don't know it," Harry said.
"I know you do not," the defense professor said sharply, "or you would not be pestering me about it. The power of unicorn's blood is to preserve your life for a time, even if you are on the very verge of death."
There was a stretch of time when Harry's brain claimed to be refusing to process the words, which was, of course, a lie, because you couldn't know the meaning you weren't allowed to process without having already processed it. A strange sense of blankness overtook Harry, an absence of reaction. Maybe this was what other people felt like when someone went off script and they couldn't say or think of anything to do. Of course, Professor Quirrell was dying, not just occasionally ill. Professor Quirrell had known he was dying. He had volunteered to take the defense professor position at Hogwarts, after all. Of course, he'd been getting worse the whole school year. Of course, illnesses which kept getting worse had a predictable destination at their end. Harry's brain had surely known already, somewhere in the safe back of his mind where he could refuse to process things he'd already processed. Of course, that was why Professor Quirrell wouldn't be able to teach battle magic next year. Professor McGonagall wouldn't have to fire him. He would just be... dead.
"No,"
Harry said, his voice a little shaky.
"There has to be a way."
"I'm not stupid, nor particularly eager to die. I have already looked. I had to go this far simply to last out my lesson plans, having less time than I had thought, and..."
The head of the dark, moonlit figure turned away.
"I think I do not want to hear about it, Mr. Potter."
Harry's breath hitched. Too many emotions were bubbling up in him at once. After denial came anger, according to a ritual someone had just made up, and yet it seemed surprisingly appropriate.
"And why?"
Harry's breath hitched again.
"Why isn't unicorn's blood standard in healer's kits, then? To keep someone alive, even if they're on the very verge of dying, from their legs being eaten?"
Because there are permanent side effects, Professor Quirrell said quietly.
Side effects? Side effects? What kind of side effect is medically worse than death?
Harry's voice rose on the last word until he was shouting.
Not everyone thinks the same way we do, Mr. Potter. Though, to be fair, the blood must come from a live unicorn, and the unicorn must die in the drinking. Would I be here otherwise?
Harry turned, stared at the surrounding trees.
Have a herd of unicorns at St. Mungo's? Flew the patients there, or use portkeys?
Yes, that would work.
Harry's face tightened, the only outward sign behind his trembling hands of everything that was welling up inside him.
He needed to scream, needed some outlet, needed something he couldn't name. And finally, Harry leveled his wand at a tree and shouted,
Defendo!
There was a sharp, tearing sound, and a cut appeared across the wood.
Defendo!
Another cut. Harry had learned the charm only 10 days previously, after he'd started getting serious about self-defense. It was theoretically a second-year charm, but the anger pouring through him seemed to know no bounds. He knew enough now not to exhaust himself, and he still had power yet.
Defendo!
Harry had aimed at a branch this time, and it plummeted to the ground with a sound of twigs and leaves. There didn't seem to be any tears inside him. Only pressure, with no outlet.
I shall leave you to it, Professor Quirrell said quietly.
The defense professor rose from his tree stump, the unicorn's blood still moonlit on the black cloak he wore, and drew his hood back over his head. Chapter 101 Precautionary Measures, Part 2 Harry stood, panting, in the midst of a brief, wasted circle amid the forest. More destruction than a first year should have been able to reach, by himself. The severing charm wouldn't bring down a tree, so he'd started partially transfiguring cross-sections through the wood. It hadn't let out what was inside him. Bringing down a small circle of trees hadn't made him feel any better. All the emotions were still there. But while he was destroying trees, he at least wasn't thinking about how the feelings couldn't be let out. After Harry had run out of available magic, he'd started tearing off branches with his bare hands and snapping them. His hands were bleeding, though nothing that Madame Pomfrey couldn't fix in the morning. Only dark magic left permanent scars on wizards. There came the sound of something moving in the woods, like the hoofbeats of a horse, and Harry whirled, his wand rising once more. Some part of his magic had returned while he was working with his hands. It occurred to him, for the first time, that he was out in the Forbidden Forest, alone, and making noise. What emerged into the moonlight was not the unicorn Harry had expected, but a creature with a lower body like that of a horse, gleaming white-brown beneath the moonlight, and the bare upper chest of a male human with long white hair. The moonlight caught the centaur's face, and Harry saw that the eyes were almost as blue as Dumbledore's, halfway to sapphire. In one hand, the centaur held a long wooden spear, with an over-large metal blade whose edge did not gleam beneath the moonlight. A gleaming edge, Harry had once read, was the sign of a dull blade.
"So,"
the creature said. His voice was low, powerful and male.
"Here you are, surrounded by destruction. I can smell the unicorn's blood in the air. The blood of something innocent, slain to save oneself."
A jolt of sudden fear brought Harry into the now, and he said quickly,
"It's not what it looks like."
"I know. The stars themselves proclaim your innocence, ironically enough."
The centaur took a step toward Harry within the small clearing, still holding his spear upright.
"A strange word, innocence. It means lack of knowledge, like the innocence of a child, and also means lack of guilt. Only those entirely ignorant can lack all responsibility for the consequences of their actions. He knows not what he does, and therefore can be without harmful intent. So says that word."
The deep voice did not echo in the woods. Harry's eyes flickered to the spear tip, and he realized that he should have grabbed his time-turner the moment he saw the centaur. Now, if Harry tried to reach beneath his robes, the spear could strike him before then, if the centaur was fast enough.
"I read once," Harry said, his voice a bit unsteady as he tried to match deep-sounding words to deep-sounding words, "that it's wrong to think of little children as innocent, because not knowing isn't the same as not choosing. That children do little harms to each other with schoolyard fights, because they don't have the power to do great harm. And some adults do great harm, but the adults who don't, aren't they more innocent than children, not less?"
"The wisdom of wizards," the centaur said.
Muggle wisdom, actually."
"Of the magicless, I know little. Mars has been dim of late, but it grows brighter."
The centaur took another step forwards, bringing him almost within striking distance of Harry. Harry didn't dare look up to the sky.
"That means Mars is coming closer to the Earth as both planets go around the sun. Mars is reflecting the same amount of sunlight as always. It's just getting nearer to us." "What do you mean, the stars proclaim my innocence?"
"The night sky speaks to centaurs. It is how we know what we know. Or do they not even tell wizards that much these days?"
A look of contempt crossed the centaur's face.
"I tried to look up centaurs when I was checking out divination. Most of the authors just ridiculed centaur divination without explaining why. Wizards don't understand argumentative norms. To them, ridiculing an idea or a person feels like casting that idea down just as much as bringing evidence against it. I thought the part about centaurs using astrology was just more ridicule."
"Why?"
the centaur intoned, his head cocked curiously.
"Because the course of the planets is predictable for thousands of years in advance. If I talked to the right muggles, I could show you a diagram of exactly what the planets will look like from this spot 10 years later. Would you be able to make predictions from that?"
The centaur shook his head.
From a diagram? No. The light of the planets, the comets, the subtle shifts in the stars themselves. Those I would not see.
Cometary orbits are also set thousands of years in advance, so they shouldn't correlate much to current events. And the light of the stars takes years to travel from the stars to Earth, and the stars don't move much at all, not visibly. So the obvious hypothesis is that centaurs have a native magical talent for divination, which you just, well, project onto the night sky.
Perhaps, the centaur said thoughtfully. His head lowered. The others would strike you for saying such a thing, but I have ever sought to know what I do not know. Why the night sky can foretell the future, that I surely do not know. It is hard enough to grasp the skill itself. All I can say, son of Lily, is that even if what you are saying is true, it does not seem useful.
Harry allowed himself to relax a little. Being addressed as Son of Lily implied that the centaur thought of him as more than a random intruder in the forest. Besides, attacking a Hogwarts student would probably bring some kind of huge reprisal upon the non-wizard centaur tribe in the forests, and the centaur probably knew that.
What muggles have learned is that there is a power in the truth, in all the pieces of the truth which interact with each other, which you can only find by discovering as many truths as possible. To do that, you can't defend false beliefs in any way, not even by saying the false belief is useful. It might not seem to matter whether your predictions are really based on the stars, or if it's an innate talent being projected, but if you want to really understand divination, or for that matter the stars, the real truth about centaur predictions would be a fact that matters to other truths.
Slowly, the centaur nodded.
So, the wandlers have become wiser than the wizards. What a joke. Tell me, son of Lily, do the muggles, in their wisdom, say that soon the skies will be empty?
Empty? Harry said. Ah, no.
The other centaurs in this forest have stayed from your presence, for we are sworn not to set ourselves against the heaven's course, because in becoming entangled in your fate, we might become less innocent in what is to come. I alone have dared approach you.
I don't understand.
No, you are innocent, as the stars say. And to slay something innocent, to save oneself, that is a terrible deed. One would live only a cursed life, a half life from that day. For any centaur would surely be cast out if he slew a foal.
The spear made a lightning motion, too fast for Harry's eyes to follow, and smashed his wand out of his hand. Another powerful blow smashed into Harry's solar plexus, and he went gasping and retching to the forest floor. Harry's hand reached up toward his robes, for his time-turner, and the spear butt knocked his hand away, almost hard enough to break fingers. He reached with his other hand, and that was knocked away too.
"I am sorry, Harry Potter,"
the centaur said, and then looked up with widened eyes. The spear spun about and came up, intercepting a red stun bolt. Then the centaur dropped the spear and leaped away desperately. A green flash of light went past him, and another green flash of light followed in its wake. Then a third green flash hit the centaur straight on. The centaur fell and did not move again. It took a long time for Harry to catch his breath, to stagger to his feet, to pick up his wand, to croak,
"What?"
By that time, the sense of doom, the power almost tangible in the air, had approached once more.
But Professor Quirrell, what are you doing here?
Well, the man in the black cloak said thoughtfully, you needed to fly into a rage and have a loud tantrum in the Forbidden Forest in the middle of the night. And I needed to go just outside your ability to detect me and keep watch. One does not leave a student alone in the Forbidden Forest. That should be obvious in retrospect.
Harry stared at the fallen centaur. The horse form wasn't breathing.
You killed him? That was Avada Kedavra.
I do not always understand how other people imagine morality to work, Mr. Potter. But even I know that on conventional morality, it is acceptable to kill non-human creatures which are about to slay a wizard child. Perhaps you do not care about the non-human part, but he was about to kill you. He was hardly innocent.
The defense professor stopped, looking at Harry, who had raised one trembling hand to his mouth.
Well, the defense professor said then, I have made my point, and you may think on it. Centaur spears can block many spells, but no one tries to block if they see that the spell is a certain shade of green. For this purpose, it is useful to know some green stunning hexes. Really, Mr. Potter, you should understand by now how I operate.
The defense professor came nearer to the centaur's body, and Harry took an involuntary step back. Then another at the terrible rising sense of
stop! Don't!
The defense professor kneeled and pressed his wand to the centaur's head. The wand stayed there for a time, and the centaur rose, eyes blank, breathing once more.
Remember nothing of this time, the defense professor commanded. Wander away, and forget everything about this night.
The centaur walked away, the four horse legs moving in strange synchrony.
Happy now?
The defense professor said, sounding rather sardonic about it. Harry's brain still felt broken.
He was trying to kill me.
Oh, for Merlin's sake. Yes, he was trying to kill you. Get used to it. Only boring people never have that experience.
Harry's voice emerged hoarse.
Why did he want to?
Any number of reasons. I would be lying if I said I'd never considered killing you myself.
Harry stared at where the centaur had wandered into the trees. His brain still felt half broken, like an engine misfiring, but Harry did not see how this could possibly be a good sign. The news of Draco Malfoy nearly being eaten by a horror had been sufficient to summon back Dumbledore from wherever he had gone, to wake Lord Malfoy and the Lady Greengrass's handsome husband to bring forth Amelia Bones. The supposed presence of the Horror had provoked scepticism even from Dumbledore, and the possibility of false memory charms had been raised. Harry had said, after some internal debate about the consequences of people believing a demon was on the loose, that he didn't actually remember making the same effort he'd put forth to frighten the Dementor. The dark thing had just left, which was what you would expect someone to create as a false memory, if they hadn't actually known how Harry had done it. The names of Bellatrix Black, Severus Snape, and Quirinus Quirrell had been mentioned in connection with wizards strong enough to subdue everyone present and cast false memory charms, and Harry had known that Lucius was thinking of Dumbledore. There had been auras testifying, and discussions going on in circles, and glares of accusation and cutting remarks at 2 a.m. in the morning. There had been motions, and votes, and consequences.
"Do you believe?"
Headmaster Dumbledore said quietly to Harry when all of it was done and the two of them were alone.
"That the Hogwarts you have wrought is an improvement."
Harry sat with his elbows on his knees, his face resting on his palms, in the conference room from which all the others had now departed. Professor McGonagall, who did not use a time-turner as routinely as the two of them, had departed swiftly for her bed.
"Yes,"
Harry answered after too long a hesitation.
"From my perspective, Headmaster, things in Hogwarts are finally, finally normal. This is how things should be when four children get sent into the Forbidden Forest at night. There should be a huge fuss, constables showing up, and the responsible party getting sacked."
"You believe it is good,"
Dumbledore said quietly,
"that the man who you called responsible was, as you put it, sacked?"
"Yes, in fact, I do."
"Argus Filch has served this institution for decades."
"And when given Veritaserum," Harry said tiredly, "Argus Filch revealed that he had sent an 11-year-old boy into the Forbidden Forest, hoping something awful would happen to him, because he thought the boy's father had been responsible for the death of his cat. The three other students in Draco's company don't seem to have fazed him. I would have argued for jail time, but your concept of jail in this country is Azkaban. I'll also note that Filch was remarkably unpleasant to the children in Hogwarts, and I expect the school's hedonic index to be improved by his departure. Not that it matters to you, I suppose."
The headmaster's eyes were impenetrable behind the half-moon glasses.
"Argus Filch is a squib. His work at Hogwarts is all he has had. Rather."
"The purpose of a school is not to provide work for its employees. I know you probably spent more time around Filch than around any individual student, but that shouldn't make Filch's inner experience loom larger in your thoughts. Students have inner lives too."
"You don't care at all, do you, Harry?"
Dumbledore's voice was quiet.
"About those you hurt."
"I care about the innocent," Harry said. "Like Mr. Hagrid, who, you'll note, I argued should not be considered malicious, just oblivious. I was fine with Mr. Hagrid working here, so long as he didn't take anyone into the Forbidden Forest again.
I had thought that, with Rubeus vindicated, he might teach care of magical creatures after Sylvanus departs the position. But much of that teaching is done in the Forbidden Forest, so that too shall not be, in the wake of your passage.
Harry said slowly,
But you told us that Mr. Hagrid has a blind spot when it comes to magical creatures, threatening wizards. That Mr. Hagrid had a cognitive deficit and couldn't really imagine Draco and Tracy getting hurt, which was why Mr. Hagrid didn't see anything wrong with leaving them alone in the Forbidden Forest at night. Was that not true?
It is true.
Then wouldn't Mr. Hagrid be the worst possible teacher for magical creatures?
The old wizard gazed down at Harry through the half-moon glasses. His voice was thick when he spoke.
Mr. Malfoy himself saw nothing awry. It was not so implausible a trick which Argus played, Harry Potter. And Rubeus might have grown into his position. It would have been all Rubeus wished, his one greatest desire.
Your mistake,
Harry said, looking down at his knees, feeling at least 10% as exhausted as he'd ever been,
is a cognitive bias we would call, in the trade, scope insensitivity. Failure to multiply. You're thinking about how happy Mr. Hagrid would be when he heard the news. Consider the next 10 years, and 1,000 students taking magical creatures, and 10% of them being scolded by Ashwinders. No one student would be hurt as much as Mr. Hagrid would be happy, but there'd be 100 students being hurt, and only one happy teacher.
Perhaps,
the old wizard said.
And your own error, Harry, is that you do not feel the pain of those you hurt once you have done your multiplication.
Maybe.
Harry went on staring at his knees.
Or maybe it's worse than that. Headmaster, what does it mean if a centaur doesn't like me? What does it mean when a member of a race of magical creatures known for divination gives you a lecture on people who are ignorant of consequences, apologizes, and then tries to stab you with a spear?
A centaur?
The headmaster said.
When did you... the time turner. You are the reason why I could not travel back to before the event on pain of paradox.
Am I? I guess I am.
Harry shook his head distantly.
Sorry.
With very few exceptions,
Dumbledore said,
centaurs do not like wizards at all.
This was a bit more specific than that.
What did the centaur say to you?
Harry didn't reply.
Ah.
The headmaster hesitated.
Centaurs have been wrong many times, and if there is anyone in the world who could confuse the stars themselves, it is you.
Harry looked up and saw the blue eyes, once more gentle, behind the half-circle glasses.
"Do not fret too much about it,"
said Albus Dumbledore. Chapter 102. Caring.
June 3rd, 1992.
Professor Quirrell was very sick. He had seemed better for a while, after drinking his unicorn's blood in May, but the air of intense power which had surrounded him afterward hadn't lasted even a day. By the Ides of May, Professor Quirrell's hands had been trembling again, though subtly. The defense professor's medical regimen had been interrupted too early, it seemed. 6 days ago, Professor Quirrell had collapsed at dinner time. Madame Pomfrey had tried to forbid Professor Quirrell from teaching classes, and Professor Quirrell had shouted at her in front of everyone. The defense professor had shouted that he was dying regardless, and would use his remaining time as he chose. So, Madame Pomfrey, blinking hard, had forbidden the defense professor from doing anything except teaching his classes. She'd asked for a volunteer to help her take Professor Quirrell to a room in the Hogwarts infirmary. More than 100 students had risen to their feet, only half wearing green. The defense professor no longer sat at the head table during mealtimes. He didn't cast spells during lessons. The oldest students who had the most Quirrell points helped him to teach. The seventh years, who had already sat their defense NEWTs in May. They took turns floating him from his room in the infirmary to his classes, and brought him food at mealtimes. Professor Quirrell proctored his battle magic classes from a chair, sitting. Watching Hermione die had hurt more than this, but that had ended much more quickly.
"This is the true enemy."
Harry had already thought that after Hermione had died. Being forced to watch Professor Quirrell die, day by day, week by week, had not done much to change his mind.
"This is the true enemy I have to face,"
Harry's thought in Wednesday's defense class, watching Professor Quirrell leaning far to one side of his chair before that day's seventh-year assistant caught him.
"Everything else is just shadows and distraction."
Harry had been turning over Trelawney's prophecy in his mind, wondering if maybe the true Dark Lord had nothing to do with Lord Voldemort at all.
"Born to those who have thrice defied him,"
seemed to strongly invoke the Peverell brothers and the three Deathly Hallows, though Harry didn't exactly see how death could have marked him as an equal, which seemed to imply some sort of deliberate action on death's part.
"This alone is the true enemy,"
Harry thought.
"After this will come Professor McGonagall, Mum and Dad, even Neville in his time. Unless the wound in the world can be healed before then."
There was nothing Harry could do. Madame Pomfrey was already doing for Professor Quirrell what magic could do, and magic seemed strictly superior to Muggle techniques when it came to healing. There was nothing Harry could do. Nothing he could do. Nothing. Nothing at all. Harry raised his hand and knocked upon the door, in case the person there could no longer detect him.
"What is it?"
came a strained voice from the infirmary room.
"It's me."
There was a long pause.
"Come in," said that voice.
Harry slipped inside and closed the door behind him and cast the quieting charm. He stood as far away from Professor Quirrell as he could, just in case his own magic was making the professor feel uncomfortable, though the sense of doom was fading with each passing day. Professor Quirrell was lying back in his infirmary bed, only his head propped up by a pillow. A coverlet of cottony material, red with black stitching, covered him to his chest. A book hovered before his eyes, outlined in a pale glow which also surrounded a black cube lying by the bed. Not the defense professor's own magic, then, but a device of some kind. The book was Thinking Physics by Epstein, the same book Harry had lent to Draco a few months back. Harry had stopped fretting about its possible misuse several weeks earlier.
"This..."
Professor Quirrell said and coughed. It didn't sound quite right.
"This is a fascinating book. If I'd ever realized..."
A laugh mixed with another cough.
"Why did I assume the Muggle arts must not be mine? That they would be of no use to me? Why did I never bother trying to test it experimentally, as you would say, in case my assumption was wrong? It seems surely foolish of me, in retrospect."
Harry was having more trouble speaking than Professor Quirrell was. Wordlessly, Harry reached into his pocket and laid a kerchief on the floor, which he unfolded to reveal a small white pebble, smooth and round.
"What's that?"
said the defense professor.
It's a transfigured unicorn."
Harry had checked the books, had learned that since he was too young to have sexual thoughts, he would be able to approach a unicorn without fear. The same books had said nothing about unicorns being smart. Harry had already noticed that every intelligent magical species was at least partially humanoid, from merfolk to centaurs to giants, from elves to goblins to vela. All had essentially human-like emotions. Many were known to interbreed with humans. Harry had already reasoned out that magic didn't create new intelligence, but just changed the shape of genetically human beings. Unicorns were equinoid, were not even partially humanoid, didn't talk, used no tools, they were almost certainly just magical horses. If it was right to eat a cow to feed yourself for a day, then it had to be right to drink a unicorn's blood in order to stave off death for weeks. You couldn't have it both ways. So Harry had gone into the Forbidden Forest, wearing his cloak. He had searched the grove of unicorns until he saw her. A proud creature with a pure white coat and violet hair, with three blue blotches on her flank. Harry had gone over, and the sapphire eyes had stared at him inquisitively. Harry had tapped out the sequence, 1, 2, 3, on the ground several times with his shoes. The unicorn had shown no sign of responding in kind. Harry had reached over, taken her hoof in his hand, and tapped the same sequence with the unicorn's hoof. The unicorn had only looked at him curiously. And something about feeding the unicorn the sleeping potion laced sugar cubes had still felt like murder.
"That magic gives their existence a weight of meaning which no mere animal could possess."
"To slay something innocent to save oneself, that is a very grave sin."
Those two phrases, from Professor McGonagall, from the Centaur, had both run through Harry's mind over and over as the white unicorn had yawned, laid down on the ground, and closed its eyes for what would be the last time. The transfiguration had lasted an hour, and Harry's eyes had watered repeatedly as he worked. The unicorn's death might not have come then, but it would come soon enough, and it was foreign to Harry's nature to try to refuse responsibility of any kind. Harry would just have to hope that, if you didn't kill the unicorn to save yourself, if you did it to help a friend, it would be acceptable in the end. Professor Quirrell's eyebrows had climbed toward his hairline. His voice was less soft, had something of his normal sharpness as he said,
"I forbid you from doing that again."
"I wondered if you'd say that," Harry said. He swallowed again. "But this unicorn is already doomed, so you might as well take it, Professor."
"Why have you done this?"
If the defense professor really didn't understand that, he was slower on the uptake than anyone Harry had ever met.
"I kept thinking there was nothing I could do," Harry said. "I got tired of thinking it."
Professor Quirrell closed his eyes. His head leaned back into the pillow.
"You were lucky," the defense professor said in a soft voice, "that a unicorn in transfigured form did not set off the Hogwarts wards as a strange creature. I shall have to take this outside the grounds to make use of it, but that can be managed. I shall tell them that I wish to look upon the lake. I will ask you to sustain the transfiguration before you go, and it should last long enough after that. And with my last strength, dispel whatever death alarms were placed to watch over the herd, which, the unicorn being not yet dead, but only transfigured, will not yet have triggered. You were very lucky, Mr. Potter."
Harry nodded. He started to speak, then stopped again. Words seemed to stick in his throat once more.
"You already calculated the expected utilities. If it works, if it goes wrong, you assigned probabilities. You multiplied, and then you threw out the answer and went with your new gut feeling, which was the same. So say it." "Do you know," Harry said unsteadily, "of any way at all by which your life might be saved?"
The defense professor's eyes opened.
"Why do you ask me that, boy?"
"There's a spell I heard of, a ritual."
"Be silent," said the defense professor.
An instant later, a snake lay in the bed. Even the snake's eyes were dull. It did not rise.
"Speak on,"
hissed that snake, its flickering tongue its only motion.
There is a ritual I heard of from the schoolmaster, by which he thinks the Dark Lord might have lived on. It is called..."
And Harry stopped, as he realized that he did know how to say the word in Parseltongue.
Horcrux! It requires a death, I have heard. But if you are dying in any case, you might try to adapt the ritual, even at great risk for the new spell, so that it can be done with a different sacrifice. It would change the whole world if you succeed, though I don't know anything about the spell. The schoolmaster thought it tore off a piece of soul, though I don't see how that could be true.
The snake was hissing laughter. Strange, sharp laughter. Almost hysterical.
You tell me of that spell. Me! You must learn more caution in the future, boy. But it matters not. I learned of the Horcrux spell since long ago. It is meaningless.
Meaningless?
Harry said aloud in surprise.
Would be pointless spell from beginning, if souls existed. Tear piece of soul? That is lie. Misdirection to hide true secret. Only one who does not believe in common lies will reason further, see beneath obstruction, realize how to cast spell. Required murder is not sacrificial ritual at all. Sudden death sometimes makes ghost if magic bursts and imprints on nearby thing. Horcrux spell channels death burst through caster, creates own ghosts instead of victims, imprints ghost in special device. Second victim picks up Horcrux device. Device imprints your memories into them, but only memories from time Horcrux device was made. You see flaw?
The burning sensation was back in Harry's throat.
No continuity of...
There wasn't a snake word for consciousness.
Self. You would go on thinking after making the Horcrux. Then self, with new memories, dies and is not restored.
Yes, you do see. Also, Merlin's interdict prevents powerful spells from passing through such a device, since it is not truly alive. Dark wizards who think to return thus are weaker, easily dispatched. None have persisted long by such means. Personalities change, mix with victims. Death is not truly gainst. Real self is lost, as you say. Not my present taste. Admit I considered it long ago.
A man was lying in the infirmary bed once more. The defense professor breathed, then made a wretched coughing sound.
"Can you give me a full recipe for the spell?"
Harry said, after a moment's deliberation.
"There might be some way to improve on the flaws, with enough research. Some way to do it ethically, and have it work."
"Like doing the transfer into a clone body with a blank brain, instead of an innocent victim, which might also improve the fidelity of the personality transfer. though that still left the other problems. Professor Quirrell made a short sound under his breath that might have been laughter.
"You know, boy," Professor Quirrell whispered, "I had thought to teach you everything, the seeds of all the secrets I knew, from one living mind to another, so that later, when you found the right books, you would be able to understand. I would have passed on my knowledge to you, my heir. We would have begun as soon as you asked me. But you never asked."
Even the grief surrounding Harry like thick water gave way to that, to the sheer magnitude of the missed opportunity.
"I was supposed to... I didn't know I was supposed to..."
Another coughing chuckle.
"Yes. The unknowing Muggle-born, in heritage, if not in blood, that is you. But I thought better of it, that you should not walk my path. It was not a good path in the end."
"It's not too late, Professor,"
Harry said. A part of Harry yelled that he was being selfish, and then another part shouted that down. There would be other people to help.
"Yes, it is too late. And you shall not persuade me otherwise. I have thought better of it, as I said. I am too full of secrets better left unknown. Look at me."
Harry looked, almost despite himself. He saw a still, unwrinkled face, looking old and pained beneath the head rapidly losing its hair, even the sides looking wispy now. Harry saw a face he'd always thought was sharp, now revealed as thin, muscle and fat fading away from the face, as from the arms beneath it. Like the skeletal form of Bellatrix Black he had seen in Azkaban. Harry's head wrenched aside, unthinkingly.
"You see," whispered the professor. "I dislike to sound cliché, Mr. Potter, but the truth is, the arts called dark really are not good for a person in the end."
Professor Quirrell breathed in, breathed out. There was quiet for a time in the infirmary. The two of them watched only by the elaborately ornamented stone of the walls.
"Is there anything left unsaid between us?" said Professor Quirrell. "I am not dying today, mind you. Not right now. But I do not know how long I shall be able to converse."
"There's..."
Harry said, swallowed again.
"There's a lot of things. Way too many things. But it might be the wrong thing to ask. But I don't want this one question unanswered. Snake?"
A snake lay on the bed.
"I learned how the killing curse works requires true hate to cast. Not much hate, but must want target dead, they say. In prison with life eaters, you cast killing curse at guard. Said you did not want him dead. Was that lie? Here, now, at this distance, you may speak truth. Even if you fear it reflects poorly on you, it should not matter now, teacher. I wish to know, must know, will not abandon you either way.
A man lay on the bed.
Listen carefully, Professor Quirrell whispered. I will tell you a conundrum, a riddle of a dangerous spell. When you know the answer to that puzzle, you will also know the answer to your question. Are you listening?
Harry nodded.
There is a limitation to the killing curse. To cast it once in a fight, you must hate enough to want the other dead. To cast Avada Kedavra twice, you must hate enough to kill twice. To cut their throats with your own hands. To watch them die. Then do it again. Very few can hate enough to kill someone 5 times. They would get bored.
The defense professor breathed several times before continuing.
But if you look at history, you will find some dark wizards who could cast the killing curse over and over. A 19th century witch who called herself Dark Evangel. The Aurors called her A.K. McDowell. She could cast the killing curse 12 times in 1 fight. Ask yourself, as I asked myself, what is the secret that she knew? What is deadlier than hate and flows without limit?
A second level to the Avada Kedavra spell, just like with the Patronus charm. I don't really care,
Harry answered. The defense professor chuckled wetly.
Good. You are learning. So, you see.
A pause of transformation.
I did not wish guard death, after all. Cast killing curse, but not with hate.
And then a man. Harry swallowed hard. It was both better and worse than what Harry had suspected, and characteristic enough of Professor Quirrell. A cracked soul, for certain, but Professor Quirrell had never claimed to be whole.
Any else to say?
Said the man in the bed.
Are you absolutely sure,
Harry said,
that there is nothing you've ever heard of that might save you, Professor? in all your lore, finding and uniting all three Deathly Hallows. An ancient artifact that Merlin sealed behind a riddle nobody's ever figured out. You've seen some of what I can do, that I'm good at solving riddles. You know I can figure things out sometimes that other wizards can't. I...
Harry's voice broke.
I have a strong preference for your life over your death, Professor Quirrell.
There was a long pause.
One thing, whispered Professor Quirrell. One thing that might do it, or it might not, but to obtain it is beyond your power or mine.
Oh, it was just the setup for a subquest, said Harry's inner critic.
All the other parts screamed for that part to shut up. Life didn't work like that. Ancient artifacts could be found, but not in a month. Not when you couldn't leave Hogwarts and were still in your first year. Professor Quirrell took in a deep breath, exhaled.
I'm sorry. That came out too dramatic. Do not get your hopes up, Mr. Potter. You asked for anything, no matter how unlikely. There is a certain object called...
A snake lay on the bed.
The Philosopher's Stone,
hissed the snake. If there'd been a mass manufacturable means of safe immortality this entire time, and nobody had bothered, Harry was going to snap and kill everyone.
I read of it in a book,
Harry hissed.
Concluded it was obvious myth. No reason why same device would provide immortality and endless gold. Not unless someone was just inventing happy stories. Not to mention, every sane person should have been researching ways to make more stones, or kidnapping Maker to produce. Thought of you specifically, teacher.
A hissing of cold laughter.
Reasoning is wise, but not wise enough. Like with Horcrux spell, absurdity hides true secret. True stone is not what that legend says. True power is not what stories claim. Stone's supposed maker was not one who made it. One who holds it now was not born to name now used. Yet stone is powerful healing device in truth. Have you heard it spoken of?
Just in the book.
One who holds stone is repository of much lore. Taught schoolmaster many secrets. Schoolmaster has said nothing of stone's holder. Nothing of stone, no hints.
Not that I can easily recall,
Harry replied honestly.
Ah,
hissed the snake.
Ah, well.
Could ask schoolmaster.
No, do not ask him, boy. He would not take question well.
But if stone only heals...
Schoolmaster does not believe that, would not believe that. too many have sought stone or sought holder's law. Do not ask, must not ask. Do not try to obtain stone yourself. I forbid.
A man lay on the bed once more.
I am at my limit, said Professor Quirrell. I must regain my strength before I go to the forest with your gift. Leave now, but sustain the transfiguration before you go.
Harry reached out, touched the white pebble lying within the kerchief, renewing the transfiguration on it.
It should last for 1 hour and 53 minutes after this, Harry said.
Your studies do well.
It was far longer than Harry's transfigurations had lasted at the start of the school year. Second-year spells came to him easily now, without strain, which wasn't surprising, since he would be 12 in less than 2 months. Harry could even have cast a memory charm, if it had been good for someone to forget every memory involving their left arm. He was climbing the power ladder, slowly, from very far down. The thought came with the potential for sadness, a thought of one door opening as another closed, which Harry also rejected. The door to the infirmary closed behind Harry as the boy who lived walked swiftly and with purpose, shrugging on his invisibility cloak as he moved. Soon, presumably, Professor Quirrell would call for assistance, and an older student trio would guide the defense professor into some quiet place, maybe the forest, with an excuse of viewing the lake or some such. Some place the defense professor could eat a unicorn undetected, after Harry's transfiguration wore off. And then Professor Quirrell would be healthier, for a time. His power would return to him as strong as it ever been, for a much shorter time. It wouldn't last. Harry's fists clenched as he strode, the tension radiating up his arm muscles. If the defense professor's treatment regimen hadn't been interrupted by Harry and the auras that he had brought to Hogwarts, it was stupid to blame himself. Harry knew it was stupid, and somehow his brain was doing it anyway. Like his brain was searching, carefully finding and selecting some way for this to be his fault, no matter how far it had to stretch. As if having things be his fault were the only way that his brain knew how to grieve. A trio of seventh-year Slytherins passed Harry's invisible form in the hallway, heading for the healer's office where the professor waited, looking deeply serious and concerned. Was that how other people grieved? Or did they, on some level, not really care, as Professor Quirrell thought?
There is a second level to the killing curse.
Harry's brain had solved the riddle instantly, in the moment of first hearing it, as though the knowledge had always been inside him, waiting to make itself known. Harry had read once, somewhere, that the opposite of happiness wasn't sadness, but boredom, and the author had gone on to say that to find happiness in life, you asked yourself not what would make you happy, but what would excite you. And by the same reasoning, hatred wasn't the true opposite of love. Even hatred was a kind of respect that you could give to someone's existence. If you cared about someone enough to prefer their dying to their living,
It meant you were thinking about them.
It had come up much earlier, before the trial, in conversation with Hermione, when she'd said something about magical Britain being prejudiced, with considerable and recent justification. And Harry had thought, but not said, that at least she had been led into Hogwarts to be spat upon. Not like certain people living in certain countries, who were, as it was said, as human as anyone else, who were said to be sapient beings, worth more than any mere unicorn, but who, nonetheless, wouldn't be allowed to live in Muggle Britain. On that score, at least, no Muggle had the right to look a wizard in the eye. Magical Britain might discriminate against Muggle-borns, but at least it allowed them inside, so they could be spat upon in person.
"What is deadlier than hate, and flows without limit?" "Indifference,"
Harry whispered aloud the secret of a spell he would never be able to cast, and kept striding toward the library to read anything he could find, anything at all about the Philosopher's Stone. Chapter 103. Tests. June 4th, 1992. Daphne Greengrass was in the Slytherin common room, writing a letter to her lady mother, who was surprisingly intransient about power-sharing, despite not even being in Hogwarts to exercise control, when she saw Draco Malfoy stagger in through the portrait door carrying what must have been a dozen books, Vincent and Gregory behind him each carrying a dozen more. The aura who'd accompanied Malfoy stuck his head in briefly, then withdrew to who knew where. Draco looked around, then seemed to be struck by a bright idea as he staggered toward her, Vincent and Gregory following after.
"Can you help me read these?"
said Draco, sounding slightly out of breath as he approached.
"What?"
Lessons were over. Only the exams were left now.
And since when did Malfoys ask Greengrasses for help with their homework?
"These," Draco Malfoy said importantly, "are all the library books Miss Granger borrowed between April 1st and April 16th. I thought I'd go through them in case there are any clues there. Only then, I thought, maybe you should help, because you knew Miss Granger better."
Daphne stared at the books. "The General read all that in 2 weeks?"
A twinge of pain went through her heart, but she suppressed it.
"Well, I don't know if Miss Granger finished them all," Draco said. He held up a cautioning finger. "In fact, we don't know if she read any of them, or if she really borrowed them. I mean, all we observed is that the library ledger says she checked them out."
Daphne suppressed a groan. Malfoy had been talking like this for weeks. There were some people who clearly were not meant to be involved with mysterious murders because it did strange things to their minds.
"Mr. Malfoy, I couldn't read all these if I spent my whole summer doing nothing else."
"Then just skim through them, please," Draco said. "Especially if there's, you know, mysterious words scribbled in her handwriting, or a bookmark left inside, or—"
"I've seen those plays too, Mr. Malfoy."
Daphne rolled her eyes.
"Don't we have auras now for—"
"We're doomed!"
shrieked Millicent Bulstrode as she burst up from the lower chambers in the Slytherin common room. People paused to look at her.
It's Professor Quirrell.
A sudden air of attentiveness, as of long-standing disputes about to be settled.
Well, finally, someone said, as Millicent tried to catch her breath. He's only got, what, 10 days left to go bad?
11 days,
said the seventh year, who was running the betting pool.
He's gotten a little better suddenly, and he's going to summon the first years for our defence final. By surprise, in 50 minutes. A defence final?
Pansy said blankly.
But Professor Quirrell doesn't give exams. The Ministry defence final,
shrieked Millicent.
But Professor Quirrell doesn't teach anything from the Ministry curriculum,
objected Pansy. Daphne was already fleeing to her room, racing for the first-year defence textbook that she hadn't touched since September, and screaming curses inside her mind. One desk back from her, someone was crying, their soft sobs providing a background chant of despair for the classroom. Daphne looked back, expecting to see a Hufflepuff, and hoping it wasn't Hannah, and was surprised at first, though not on further reflection, to see it was a Ravenclaw. Before them were set the exam parchments, turned over, waiting for the bell. 50 minutes hadn't been nearly enough preparation time, but it was something, and Daphne was now feeling ashamed that she hadn't thought to send messengers to warn the Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, and Gryffindor houses. They'd started giving house points again just 3 days ago, at the beginning of June, but the Auxiliary Protective Special Committee still ought to promote house unity. Another Ravenclaw, sitting 4 desks to her left, also started to cry. That was Catherine Tongue of Dragon Army, if she recalled correctly, whom she'd once seen take on 3 Sunshine Soldiers simultaneously without a flinch. Daphne had calmed down after the first couple of minutes of frantic reading. It was just a test, not a murder or anything, and if almost all the first-year students turned in mostly blank parchments, then it stood to reason that nobody would be shamed. But Daphne could understand, if not exactly empathize, that Ravenclaws and Hufflepuffs might not see it that way.
He's evil,
another Ravenclaw witch said in a shaking voice.
100% pure dark wizard to the bone. The Dark Lord Grindelwald wouldn't do this. Not to children. He's worse than you know who.
Daphne looked reflectively at where Professor Quirrell was sitting, slumped to one side, but his eyes alert, and she thought she saw the defence professor smile for one tiny instant. No, that had to be her imagination. There was no way the defence professor could have heard that. The bell rang. Daphne flipped the parchment over. The top was stamped with the seals for the Ministry, the Hogwarts Board of Governors, and the Department of Magical Education, and runes to detect cheating. Below that was a line for her to write her name, and a list of exam rules with a picture of Lindsay Gunion, the director of the Department of Magical Education, shaking an admonishing finger at everyone. Halfway down the page was the first exam question. It was,
why is it important for children to stay away from strange creatures?
There was a stunned pause. One student began laughing. She thought it was from the Gryffindor section of the class. Professor Quirrell made no motion to censor it, and the laughter spread. Nobody spoke aloud, but the students looked around at each other, exchanging glances as the laughter died down. And then, as if by some unspoken agreement, they all looked at Professor Quirrell, who was smiling down at them benevolently. Daphne bent over her exam, wearing a defiant, evil smile that would have done proud to either Godric Gryffindor or Grindelwald, and she wrote down, "Because my stunning hex, my most ancient blade, and my Patronus charm won't work against everything." Harry Potter turned over the last page of his defense exam. Even Harry had needed to quash a small bit of nervousness, some tiny remnant of his childhood, upon reading the first real question.
"How can you make a shrieking eel be silent?"
Professor Quirrell's lessons had spent roughly zero time on the surprising yet useless trivia that some idiot had imagined a defense class should look like. In principle, Harry could have used his time-turner to read through the first-year defense book after being notified of the surprise exam, but that might have unfairly skewed the grading curve for others. After staring at the question for a couple of seconds, Harry had written down quieting charm and included the casting directions in case the ministry grader didn't believe that Harry knew it. Once Harry had decided to just answer all the questions correctly, the exam had gone by very quickly. The most realistic answer